to the first speaker today. Again, Kate Garuffi, who's joining us from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Kate?
All right. Thank you, Jean. All right. So welcome, everybody, to the first Design and Construction Webinar Series webinar. We're really happy to have Shane Cherry here. Before we get started on his presentation, I wanted to give folks on the phone a little bit of an understanding about the EPA and Society of American Military Engineers, or SAMMEE, collaboration. EPA holds a co-sponsorship agreement with the Society of American Military Engineers with the objective, through a series of events that are listed below on this slide, to really enhance, facilitate open and frank communication among professionals about the unique and interesting challenges we have in design and construction when dealing with uncontrolled hazardous waste sites. Our webinars, as well as our symposiums that are listed below, provide a forum for practitioners to discuss current practices and approaches. We focus a lot on project management techniques and field experiences in the areas of design and construction. This enhances communication networks and promotes continuing discussion amongst the professionals. EPA and SAMMEE have been in this co-sponsorship arrangement for about 3 or 4 years. With those co-sponsorships, the two flagship events that we've been doing are the Design and Construction at Hazardous Waste Sites, or DCHWS, East Symposium in Philadelphia. This year, April 2020, upcoming, will be our 13th delivery of that symposium. It's been wildly successful. We generally have in excess of 400 people that attend that event, ranging from about 40% the public sector, EPA, the Corps of Engineers, and states, as well as the private consultants, designers, engineers, the practitioners that are doing work for EPA and other hazardous waste programs. A sister symposium to that is the DCHWS West. The fourth delivery is coming up in a couple months in November 2019, and that will be in Denver. I'll give you some information on that in a couple following slides. Related to what we're doing here, as part of our co-sponsorship, we've decided to enhance or further facilitate the communication on design and construction issues. And starting with Shane's presentation today, we are striving to have webinars about once a month where we share design and construction topics of interest to both the private and public sector. And we're also really trying to have a forum for sharing some of the presentations that we get to experience at the Design and Construction Symposium for a wider, more spread audience and go into a little bit more detail. The seminar series, as I mentioned before, there's 8 to 10 webinars planned in fiscal year 2020. We've scheduled the webinars out through March of 2020, and I'll share a slide with those topics in a couple minutes. We are going to be sending out a request for additional topics. So if you're interested in some topics on design and construction, when we get to the feedback session of this this event, we'd really like to hear from you as to what you might be interested in. In process as well, which I think is really exciting, is EPA and SAMMEE are working with the Construction Management Association of America, a very large organization that has standards of practice in the design and construction spaces. We're working with them to do an in-person construction management training. It's tentatively scheduled for February. Registration and information is forthcoming. We'll be sharing that on future webinars and getting that information out to attendees of the SAMMEE events as well as people that are going to these webinars. And last, I'm going to give you guys an introduction of our presenter. Shane presented originally at our third Design and Construction Symposium West, which was last year. He presented on this topic. It was wildly successful. People really loved the topic. So as the first presenter, we asked him to come out, present this to a larger audience, and really get more into the weeds on some of the challenges and some of the lessons learned and best practices that he has learned from this project. Shane's background is he has a Bachelor of Science in Geology from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a Master's of Science in Geography and Environmental Engineering from Johns Hopkins, and as a Principal Scientist for Hydrogeologic, or HGL, he's worked on a variety of projects focused on applying watershed sciences to strategic remediation of contaminated sediments in rivers, lakes, and estuaries. Shane is a wealth of knowledge, so as he goes through his presentation and you guys have questions, I really encourage you to write them down and really facilitate a lot of this dialogue. He has a lot of information to share. Before I turn it over to Shane, just a couple plugs. I'm going to go through these slides quickly, and we'll come back to them after Shane's done. On this slide, you can see some of the future DCHWS CLUIN webinars. We have one in November, December, January, February, and March. They're on a variety of topics, most of which were discussed at previous symposiums and by popular demand are being brought back in a larger format. We also have some new topics. We're going to be opening registration for the next webinar in these series so that we can present it and let you guys know at this point. So just a note here, the next webinar, which is November 25th, from 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the registration's open. The link is there. And the title is on substrate longevity and long-term performance of biochemical reactors for passive treatment of mine-impacted water. So if you are dealing with abandoned mine sites, you're dealing with mine-influenced waters, this would be a really great presentation for you. The two presenters from Jacobs are really experts in their field. If you want to get information on these webinars, future webinars, please sign up for our free monthly newsletter in Tech Direct. You'll be able to see those and just give yourself a reminder to get on there and register. In addition to the CLUIN webinars, the DCHWS West Symposium, which is in November in a couple months, the registration is open. The agenda is final. It starts Monday, November 4th at 3 p.m. and ends Wednesday at noon. It's at the Grand Hyatt Denver in Denver, Colorado. There's still registration spots available. If you go to the link that's attached, you will see not only the link for the registration, but also the agenda. For my public sector, Corps of Engineers, other federal or state agencies, one of the great things about the collaboration with EPA and SAMI is that through our partnership, we do get public sector attendees, free attendance. So if you're a public sector and you can make this work, I really encourage you to attend this as well. Finally, the save the date for the DCHWS East Symposium. As I mentioned before, this is our larger symposium, over 400 public and private sector attendees. This will be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, from Wednesday, April 1st, 2020, through Friday, April 3rd, 2020. The call for abstracts is going to be going out right on the heels of the DCHWS West. So keep an eye open for that. In future webinars, I'll be giving you guys a lot more information on where to register, what the agenda is, et cetera. So with that, I am done with the introduction. And Shane, if you are ready, I'm ready to turn it over to you to get into the nitty-gritty.
All right. I'm all set. I'll wait for the slides to pop up. All right. Thank you, Kate, for the introduction, and thank you, everybody, for participating today. I really appreciate your interest. Just as a philosophy, I'm a scientist. I believe in sharing what we learn so that we can all do better work, and that is the spirit behind my presentation today. So I encourage you to ask questions today, and if you want to, take down my contact information and call me later, email me later. Happy to take your call and talk through details and help you figure out how to do this yourself. So the project that I'm going to talk about today is the Big River in Jefferson County, Missouri. It's part of a regional area that's been impacted by historic mining activity. Going back approximately 200 years for the region, back to when it was before the Louisiana Purchase, mining activities occurred there, and there's about a 150-year period of intense mining. It's impacted the landscape, and in particular the watersheds. And I'm going to talk about the Big River, and I'm also going to talk a little bit about a couple other watersheds in the region that are going to benefit from some of the same ideas. So here's the idea, and I'll say, just in context, I've been a consultant for about 22 years, and every now and then in your career you come across an idea and you think, wow, this is something different. I'd like to think that this approach that I'm going to talk about today is something different and something that could help us all accomplish more on the landscape scale with cleaning up contaminated rivers than we otherwise could. So everybody, I think, is probably familiar with the idea of natural recovery. And, you know, some people look at that down their nose and say, well, that's kind of a do-nothing approach. If we just leave the system to fix itself, it might take a long time. But it's, natural recovery is a component of most remedies when you're dealing with natural systems. What I'm going to talk about today is more than natural recovery. It's different than enhanced natural recovery. It's more of a full integration of natural processes into the remedy, where we do rely on natural processes to accomplish some large part of the cleanup, but we're not just watching it to see what it does. We're engaged in that remedy, kind of in lockstep with these natural processes. So for the big river, the concept begins with how can we use the natural river processes to aggregate the contaminated sediments? Generally, natural processes distribute and disperse contamination attached to the sediments, but there are ways to take advantage of hydraulic sorting to aggregate the sediments. There are fast-flowing segments of the channel that flush sediments downstream. Then there are other segments of the channel that are more slow-moving. They're backwatered from some obstruction or constriction in the channel. And those segments will generally deposit and store sediment in the riverbed and along the margins. The contaminated sediments accumulate in these depositional zones. One component of this approach is to strategically enhance the deposition zones, to select them and help them to be more effective in deposition. Along with that, perhaps construct sediment traps off to the side. And one or the other of those approaches may be more effective in different locations. And then over time, we remove contaminated sediments from the same locations. You know, the advantage of doing that over and over in the same places instead of dredging everywhere once is that you can build the infrastructure in fewer places, have a smaller footprint in the overall impacts of your remedy on the natural environment, and benefit from savings from both of those. So if you step back, I'm really talking about the applicability of watershed science to remedial strategy. And when you're dealing with watersheds that are impacted at that watershed scale where you have dozens or hundreds of miles of stream channel that's been impacted by mining materials, metals, you can benefit a great deal by building your conceptual site model and establishing that context as a diagnostic and then design-supporting tool, a framework for figuring out what's happening here, how does sediment move around, how do contaminants move around, where do they come to rest, and what's our best strategy for removing those from impacting receptors. The remedial strategy and the selection of effective remedial technologies is different from place to place. You have different kinds of rivers where you're going to have a different strategy for different kinds of rivers. The big river is a low gradient, meandering, muddy water kind of river. It has gravel in the bed from place to place, but there's a lot of fine material in the bed. You have 12 to 15 foot high banks of floodplain soils that are sand and silt that are also contaminated. That river is going to behave very differently than a mountain river, a river that has a gravel cobble bed, steep tributaries that are narrow in size. The transport processes and the nature of the sediment and the morphology of the channel are all going to be different, and you would expect to find contaminated fine material aggregating in different locations for a different kind of river. As part of this presentation, I'm going to compare the Big River to the Spring River to illustrate a little bit of the adaptability of this approach and how you would change the strategy and change the remedy in response to those changes in the natural environment. Another component of the talk today, I'm going to talk about treatability investigations, you know, another way to say pilot study, where you basically take your components of your remedy and you try them out at a smaller scale to work out all the bugs beforehand. We've worked on a few of those pilot studies, both at Big River and at Spring River. Now, before I go on, an important caveat, just need to talk about where we are in the process with these projects that I'm talking about today. There is not yet a published record of decision. We are working on the feasibility studies for these now, so they're still in the remedial planning phase. We have gone through design and construction for multiple pilot tests, but it's important to note that everything I talk about today is what we are doing and what we're working towards through this planning process. It's not yet recorded in a decision. And so all of this is subject to that whole process. And I'm showing my intentions, showing our intentions and our direction and our strategy that's going into building this FS. But please don't misinterpret what we're saying today as recorded in a decision. All right. So where are we in the world? State of Missouri, we are probably an hour or so drive south of St. Louis. I generally fly into St. Louis for this. Jefferson County, Missouri is a tributary, or it's the Big River flows north through Jefferson County. It originates in counties south of there. The historic mining has occurred upstream of Jefferson County for the most part. The sources of the material that's now in the river and its floodplain are further upstream. That's important to note because the process of transport, the further distance you go from the source, the more the transport processes affect the nature and location of the contaminants that you find. The river is about 120 kilometers long in Jefferson County, and you can see on the drawing, the map, that the river is very windy. It's not a straight line distance of 120, it's the distance measured along the channel. The river, as I said earlier, is a low gradient meandering channel. There are gravel and sand bed sections, and there are bedrock outcrops close to the surface along most of the length of it in Jefferson County. I'll come back to the bedrock and its influence on the river in a little while. The floodplain expands to over 2 kilometers wide in the lower half of the site. At the top, at the upstream end, you can see that the channel and its floodplain are narrow, and it gets progressively wider as you go downstream. So a little bit of background. I mentioned earlier that historic mining has gone back to the 1700s in this region. This photo on the top left is a tailings pile. You can see it's like a mountain behind this residential neighborhood. Tailings piles have millions and millions of yards of material. Thank you for the arrow. I was looking for it. So the tailings pile here is one of many, many tailings piles throughout the different mining regions in Missouri. This other photo, it's just the interior of one of the processes, that's metal ingots. This is a historic site now. This is one of the mine processing facilities. It was a mill. And then this just shows the old lead belt and the new lead belt here. I've got another graphic that shows the whole state. All of this starting, if you go all the way back to the 1700s, you know, recall that Clean Water Act came about in 1970-ish, and there are decades and decades of time before Clean Water Act, Endangered Species Act, the current primary environmental regulations that are in place, weren't there before. And so these massive mountains of mine material, mine waste, have been sitting on the landscape for decades, getting rained on, being leached, being blown around by wind, eroding landslides from these falling into the river. There are many, many different ways that material has been released into the stream network regionally. A little bit more background. Here's some of the work that HGL did, mapping out the distribution of contaminants of concern. Generally speaking, we've got green, yellow, red. On this graphic, it's too small to really see here, but just to illustrate, concentration, if it's red, it's 2 times the preliminary remedial goal, a remediation goal, a PRG. If it's yellow, it's above the PRG. If it's green, it's below the PRG. So there's variability, but generally, you're going to have higher concentrations of these metals in the sediments upstream, and it trends downstream. I'll show you more data in a minute here. This other graphic just illustrates, sorry, I was using my mouse to point, so higher concentrations grading into lower concentrations down below, but still some hits even further downstream. This shows just a sampling plot for on the floodplain. We characterized contaminants of concern in the floodplain soils, and you know, one of the mechanisms for distributing contamination is if this whole floodplain has contaminated soil, everywhere the river erodes into it, it accesses and redistributes those contaminants in an ongoing way. All right, regional context. I talked about the Big River, and that goes through or derives from the old lead belt over here. In Missouri, you also have the new lead belt. These are underground mines that are active, or most recently were active. The central mining district here in the middle of the state, and then the tri-state lead and zinc district, the tri-state mining district. The three states are Missouri, Kansas, and Oklahoma, and there are impacted watersheds in all three of those states. And in my view, this strategy to use watershed science is adaptable to apply to diverse kinds of watersheds. The commonality is we're looking at sites that are impacted with contaminants that bind to sediments. It makes the analysis a little more straightforward if you're dealing with sediments or with contaminants that go where the sediment goes. It's easier to map the fate and transport of sediments than it is to map out fate and transport of contaminants that are sometimes attached to sediment, sometimes dissolved, change phases. These contaminants are relatively well behaved in that they're predominantly attached to sediments as they move around. But as I mentioned earlier, the watersheds vary. They vary in scale. They vary in terms of the sediment that moves down these channels. How steep is the channel? How much of a floodplain, if there is one? What's the land use? What's the climate? All of these factors can make big differences in how a stream network operates. But understanding all of that as context for your planning, your diagnosis, and ultimately your treatment strategy is a sound foundation for remedial planning. And it varies with all of those factors from watershed to watershed. More on regional context, this is just a similar map to the one, same base information, but it shows extending into Kansas and Oklahoma, the tri-state lead and zinc district. There's additional mining impacted areas further into Oklahoma with Tar Creek, and then there are mining impacted watersheds all around the country. But I wanted to talk about this regional context since this is the subject I'm on today, and show the variability between these watersheds and how we've adapted the approach from place to place. Again, here's just a little bit more detail on the Tri-State Mining District. This district was more focused on zinc mining, but it's not just zinc. It's the same kind of geology that's generating these ore deposits. But note that this whole area extends further into Oklahoma, Cherokee County in Kansas, and then Jasper and Newton counties primarily in Missouri. These are multiple Superfund sites or multiple NPL sites. So back to Big River. I'm going to talk first about hydrology, you know, how much water is coming off the landscape and flowing down the river. These data just came from one of the gauges. There are multiple USGS gauges in the watershed. It's helpful to be able to show how that flow magnitude varies from place to place along the river. Notice the 100-year flood is right around 60,000 cubic feet per second. A 2-year flood is 17,700. This is fairly central in our site. And you can see over the years of this record from 1980 to almost present, here's 2015, we've got multiple events that are over 30,000 CFS. One that's getting close to, this is probably about a 50-year flood that occurred here in the last few years. So one of the issues, I'll show as many pictures of the site as I can. Bank erosion is widespread, and I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons that the river continues to recontaminate itself is there's a massive reservoir of contaminated soil in the floodplain. The mining activity spanned about 200 years, and it coincided with the agricultural revolution in this region, and a lot of landscape was converted from forest and prairie to till crops and farming. And a lot of the agricultural development occurred prior to the Soil Conservation Service. And so the whole river valley filled in several feet as a result of runoff from the landscape. So a lot of sediment deposition on this floodplain occurred at the same time that a lot of contaminated mine waste material was released into that environment. So we've got the sediment accumulation on the floodplain conflated with the release and distribution of mine waste metals. And so now that floodplain that varies from, 100 feet to 2 kilometers, sorry to mix units, but it goes from almost no floodplain to a 2 kilometer wide floodplain at the bottom. That's a massive volume of contaminated soil, and it's variable from place to place. It tends to be more contaminated along the river margins and the low-lying areas that receive more deposition. But if we have widespread bank erosion where the river is eating into contaminated floodplain soil, that's a critical mechanism for recontamination that we have to address as part of our strategy. I want to talk a little bit about sediment storage in-stream. That I just talked about the floodplain, but there are reservoirs of sediment throughout the stream network, the channel network as well. Here's an example of an extensive gravel bar. It's gravel and sand. And as you can see, the channel widens out. And generally, when you have a transition either in gradient or in how confined the channel is, you're going to promote deposition. So if you go from steep to flat, you get deposition. If you go from constrained to unconstrained, you get deposition. This is an example of that in this photo. Here's a ground level photo showing a similar bar. I don't believe these are the same location, but they look similar from place to place. Here's another image that shows a larger stretch of channel, and you can see multiple bars along here. Generally, you get deposition on the inside of a river bend. That's called a point bar, and the channel migrates away by bank erosion, and it deposits on the inside of that curve with the material in transport, because there's a gradient in velocity, depth, and shear stress on the bed across the channel, with higher forces on the outside, smaller forces on the inside. So you get deposition on the inside of these bends. You can see that along here. I mentioned earlier there are other factors that are influencing where you see the sediment storage happening in the channel. And there's a unique thing about this river that I noticed. The gravel and sand bars tend to occur in the more dynamic stretches of the river. And the river overall is very flat, but you have locally steep and locally more dynamic zones in the river at tributary confluences, and you have these locally steep channel segments immediately downstream of bedrock outcrops and other channel constrictions. The bedrock outcrops are fixed in place, and so the river has filled in over time with all of the sediment that came off the landscape and then cut back through that to be relatively incised, and it's cut back down to the limiting controls, which are the bedrock, and in the case of the tributaries are generally smaller channels. They're a little bit steeper. They bring in coarser sediment, and you end up with an extensive sediment deposition occurring just downstream of each of these tributary confluences, especially if the tributary carries a large sediment load. It brings in coarser sediment. The river can redistribute that to some degree, but generally speaking, the river is flatter, has less energy to move that sediment than the tributary does. So you end up with backwaters extending upstream of the tributaries and locally steep and dynamic zones extending downstream of those tributaries. I've got another slide that talks about that. So here's an aerial of that concept. Notice this is the tributary, and it flows from left to right here. And at the confluence, the tributary has delivered a large volume of sediment, which has been deposited in the riverbed. Upstream, there's a long stretch of flat water. It's backwatered from this mound of sediment in the riverbed. Downstream from this confluence extending down, this is locally steeper and more dynamic. You can see the channel is braided. You have multiple channel threads going through this deposit. And historically, this channel has moved around back and forth through here in response to this sediment deposition and the reworking. Here's another deposition zone, a long stretch of flat water, and another dynamic zone further downstream. In most rivers I've worked in that have a little bit more gradient, these features migrate downstream as they're transported. You'll have a slug of sediment, and that sediment is moving downstream over time. In the case of the Big River, these dynamic zones are relatively locked in place. They're locked in place by these confluences from the tributaries, which keep this dynamic zone here, and they're locked in place by the bedrock, where the river doesn't easily cut down through that bedrock. And so when you run into a bedrock zone, the rock is holding the river profile in a fixed point, and downstream of there, where the material is movable, it's created a locally steep stretch. So just a quick slide to talk about some of the environmental sampling that occurred, and I'll show some of those results. We collected samples of the riverbed sediments, the river banks, so we sampled vertical variability of contaminants in the river banks, and then we sampled the floodplain soils and transects extending away from the channel. And the idea was to characterize the chemistry of these sediments and potential future sediments so that we could get an understanding of where are the contaminants and how do they move around in the system. Here's my first graphic to show the trend downstream. You have a generally decreasing trend, which is normal. You'd expect to see the highest concentrations close to your source and diminishing with distance as there's sorting and dilution and other factors that cause that trend away from the source. So upstream is here, and moving downstream towards the confluence with the Merrimack River, we see a general downward trend. Now, this is for the floodplain soils. Notice this is a noisy trend. There's a lot of variability. Cleanup levels, depending on where we are in the landscape, you know, if we're in a residential yard or a park or a school playground, you're going to have a really low cleanup level. On a floodplain, you'll have a moderate cleanup level, but somewhere in the 400, 500, 800 parts per billion for lead, that's going to drive this cleanup. That's not specified yet. That's a preliminary numbers. But just to put this graphic in context, most of the length of this river, the floodplain soils are contaminated enough that they probably need to be remediated. A couple of details of our work. We evaluated three size classes separately. So we took the samples and we separated them with sieves and came up with three different size classes to see, is there variability in how these metal concentrations are showing up in different sizes. And we found that the finest sediment class had the largest mass and also the strongest trend in terms of these COC metals. So just for comparison, these are the riverbed sediments. Generally, the concentrations are a little bit lower for the riverbed sediments than they are for the floodplains, and that's there are different reasons for that, but you can see the same trend where you have higher concentrations upstream and trending downstream to be lower and lower. And we did the same thing with the size classes, looking at coarse, medium, and fine sediment, and fine sediment, again, has the same conclusions in terms of having the largest mass and strongest trend. So I'm a geomorphologist. My background is fluvial geomorphology. I have an undergraduate degree in geology, and then my graduate degree is in geography and environmental engineering. And if you think about engineers versus geologists, geologists tend to tell the story. I'm a storyteller. I'll tell you, how did this landscape get to be this way? And one of my favorite things about geology is going to a place and noticing all of the clues on the landscape that tell me what happened here. You know, did glaciers form this landscape? No, not here. But is this all from rivers? Is there evidence of an inland sea here millions of years ago? Geologists put together these stories of how this landscape looks, how did it get to be this way, and how does it work? Engineers tend to be more quantitative, and you come up with how fast, how much material is moving around every year, how far does it go in a single storm, how fast is this bank erode, how many tons of material comes from this stretch of river on an annual basis, and how much variability is there. I rely heavily on hydraulic and sediment transport models to bring that quantification to the storytelling process. But I also lay the groundwork to guide how do we use the models and which questions and which places do we look at and what are the scenarios that we're trying to simulate with our model. You know, how does that relate back to the real world and what's actually happening on the landscape? That combination of the story and the quantities, the estimates, and the predictive aspects of the model is a central part of this approach to remedial planning. For this project, for the Big River, we used HECRAS, version 5.0. HECRAS is a standard industry model, most often used for flood predictions and all of the FEMA maps that tell you whether or not you're in a 100-year floodplain. Those are developed using HECRAS. But most consultants that work in natural river environments are familiar with and use HECRAS for many different kinds of applications. Previously I showed the flow values from the 2-year to the 100-year floods. We ran peak flow scenarios. We had 83 surveyed transects. Now that sounds like a lot, but keep in mind this is 120 kilometers. That's a lot of space between each of those surveyed transects. We focused on characterizing river morphology relative to hydraulic controls. We also made sure to capture the bridges. There are historic mill dams as well. We made sure those were included in the model because those tend to affect the hydraulics, at least locally and sometimes further. HECRAS allows you to interpolate cross-sections so that you can get a much more dense grid. This is way more than 83 cross-sections shown in this graphic. Many of those were interpolated. We validated those with landscape data to make sure that we were characterizing the floodplain in particular. So there was a total of 241 transects overall with the interpolated sections included. We did not model the hydraulics of the tributaries, but we did include nodes for each tributary to account for the flow and sediment inputs at those tributaries. And we developed those based on the landscape, how big is the watershed, what are the dimensions of the channel, and we used HEC-HMS to help with that. We characterized the sediment. Again, I talked about sorting it into three different size classes. We incorporated those into the model, and we set our boundary conditions upstream and downstream based on information that was available from flow records. Let's see. This is just an example table of model results. We showed that the flow depth ranged from 12 to 30 feet. You know, imagine a 30-foot deep channel. There's a deep holes out there where there are long pools in those flat water segments. And this also, that depth range includes the range of flow, so going from 17,000 CFS up to 60,000 CFS. You're going to have deeper flows, of course, in the flood. The velocities in the channel that were modeled ranged from 2 to 8 feet per second. Generally, the average velocities decreased downstream. Locally, there was not a lot of difference between the velocities at high flow and low flow. And that's common for a wide floodplain river, where the floodplain has a mitigating effect on the velocities. So the size and shape of the channel dictates the velocity. Once you get up to floodplain stage, the water spreads out and the velocities in the channel don't change a lot. We use the results of the model to map out the channel segments so we could show where is deposition occurring and where is scour and transport occurring. With HEC-RAS, you can run it in a state called quasi-unsteady flow. It allows you to show variable flow, and in that mode, it allows you to calculate or estimate sediment transport. This is a screening level model, I would say, in terms of sediment transport. It balances mass from one river segment to the next, so it's an accounting of how much sediment moved from this box to the next box downstream. This graphic and this plan view show the results of the modeled sediment transport, and we'd have sediment deposition and sediment scour on opposite sides of the graph. So you end up showing how much deposition or how much scour occurs at each of these cross sections along the length of the river. A couple of things we found. Let's see if I've got this on the next slide. No, I'll mention it here. A couple of things that we found were these locations don't change across the range of flows. You know, these are driven by the shape of the channel. The shape of the channel, how big of a cross section, how wide is the floodplain, is it constricted or not? How's the gradient? How steep is it locally? So the places that scoured and the places that deposited at the 2-year flow also scoured and deposited relatively at the 100-year flow, but the magnitudes were greater. You have more scour in the scour places and more deposition in the deposition places. So that's a consistent result with the observation I made earlier that the dynamic zones of the channel are locked in place either by these tributary confluences or by the bedrock outcrops near the surface. So how do we use all of this to develop remedial alternatives? Imagine the challenge of this problem. And we have a wild dynamic river and sediment spread over 120 kilometers and deposited in floodplain soils up to 2 kilometers wide. How in the world are we going to clean this up? Well, if you think about conventional remedies, you know, the old way of doing things, the common way of doing things, especially in more quiescent settings, like say an estuary, you characterize where the contamination is, you map it out, you set cleanup levels, and then you go get it. And you take it out of the system, and if you can't get it all out, you cap it to isolate it from organisms and people and water so that you contain the problem. So if we tried to do that here, it would be an intractably expensive proposition. I mean, there's no way we could go out and remove all the contamination from the environment as dispersed as it is. So what can we do instead? You know, the other problem with that approach is you kill the patient with the cure. If we were to go and dredge the river bank to bank for 120 kilometers, or even if we picked a subset of that, but still many, many kilometers of riverbed getting dredged, we're wrecking the place. We'd be damaging the ecosystem. We'd be preventing people from using it. We'd make it ugly for all the people that like to drift down this river and fish for bass. You know, it's a heavy-handed approach. And I'd like to think that using these natural river processes and the remedy is a little bit more finesse, and it's what's needed in a setting like this. So right now we're in the middle of this, and I'll walk you through it. We'll have a meeting next month where we roll up our sleeves and do this in more detail, but I think developing a mass budget for the sediment and figuring out the COC mass budget as well with that, how much sediment is stored in the riverbed, how much sediment is stored in the floodplain, how much comes into the river by erosion of the banks year by year, how much comes from upstream, how much goes out the bottom, and how long would it take for the river to turn over the sediment that's stored in the channel. we'd have to characterize all of the inputs, you know, upstream sources, bank erosion, tributaries, riverbed sediment storage, and the outputs, downstream transport, long-term storage, isolation, and removal through remedial action. That mass budget framework, I think, will be the basis for determining how much of each remedial technology do we need to address each of these sources. How fast will they work? How long will it take to get the job done if we rely on these technologies and natural river process? It'll also provide us the framework we need to assess the rate of recovery and how effective is the remedy, or how effective are different candidate remedies. We'll be evaluating, you know, different approaches. For example, if we're using bank stabilization to keep the river from eating into contaminated floodplain soil, one alternative may have, you know, predominantly bank erosion as the strategy. Others may target removal of sediment and transport as a preferential technology. Let's go put sediment traps along the river and take out as much of the contaminated material as possible. Of course, most likely we're going to have some combination of technologies, both conventional and innovative, but this is the framework we'll use to evaluate their relative effectiveness. So a few conclusions about Big River, and I say conclusions loosely because, as I said, we're in the middle of this. We use the hydraulic analysis and the geomorphic analysis to differentiate long-term sediment storage from mobile sediment, both in the floodplain and riverbanks and in the riverbed. Sediment deposition and scour are predicted at the same locations. So as I said before, we have scour at the same places during the 2-year and the 100-year flow, and same for deposition, only the magnitude changes. We flagged 17 zones for deposition and 17 scour and transport zones, and sediment removal strategies would focus on the deposition zones. If you're going to put a sediment trap, you put it out where you're expecting deposition. Generally speaking, your sediment removal strategies are not necessary or effective in the transport zones. If the river has the wherewithal to keep the sediment moving through this mile of river, let's not go waste our time and energy and dollars digging it up if we can just wait at the bottom of that stretch and collect it. Lastly, we believe that we should prioritize bank protection where the bank erosion mobilizes contaminated floodplains soils. The contamination is widespread, but there is some variability from place to place in terms of where is the highest concentration along the riverbank. If we have actively eroding channel coincident with high concentrations of contaminants in the bed and the banks, those are going to be highest priority. And then if you have stable channel banks or very slow erosion rates, then those are going to have lower priority. So now I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to shift over to look at the Spring River. Big River is located in that old lead mine belt, and the Spring River is located in the Tri-State District, which is in southwest Missouri. The geomorphic processes and the chemicals that we're concerned about, lead, cadmium, zinc, are generally the top three players. Those are similar between these watersheds. The contaminated sediments in Spring River are predominantly located in the tributaries rather than the larger river. That's a different situation than Big River. So the tributaries in Spring River have higher concentrations. They're smaller channels. They're more dynamic. And they contain more coarse sediment than the Big River, which has a high percentage of silt and sand and fine material. Within the Spring River watershed, the primary tributaries are each distinct and separable. We can look at them each as a separate unit if we choose to for the remedy, because you know, none of the tributaries flows into the others. They all flow into the Spring River, and so we can look at them each as isolated basins for planning purposes. The Spring River upland source areas are distributed throughout the landscape really close to these tributaries. In the case of Big River, the mining waste materials were all located in the next county upstream, so dozens of miles upstream from where we're working. At Spring River, these tributaries flow right through the middle of the hottest work zone in terms of mines, historic mining activities. That proximity is reflected in what we see in the chemical distribution of the sediments. So this is the site. This is the tri-state area, Kansas on the left, Missouri on the right, Oklahoma down here. Now, Oklahoma is Region 6 EPA, Kansas, Missouri are Region 7. So we're working within Region 7, but there's a lot of crosstalk between Region 7 and Region 6 because Region 6 is downstream. This is the Upper Spring River Basin. The Lower Spring River Basin starts here and extends downstream and incorporates these other areas that drain into the Spring River. So this map is one of two that shows the historic mining activity. Every one of these red dots, now these are dots, they're really close to each other. You can see the intensity of the historic mining activity here around Joplin. And further afield, there's material upstream. This is the same boundary that I showed in the previous slide for the Upper Spring River. I'll just toggle back there quickly to show you. So that's this red boundary is the Upper Spring River watershed. That's the site that we're working in right now. Notice there are large, long tributaries that drain over here from east to west and discharge to the Spring River. The tributaries here are Center Creek, Turkey Creek, Short Creek, Shoal Creek. Those are the main tributaries that we're dealing with as part of this remedial planning exercise. So watershed science applies to the Spring River Basin in this way. We use it to refine the conceptual site model so that we can interpret the distribution of COCs and predict changes through ongoing stream processes. The watershed context and the hydraulic modeling provide a basis for determining specific locations and setting priorities for different components of the remedy. What do we do first? Where do we work first? Of course, the sequence of activities is dictated by the fact that water flows downstream. So you don't want to work downstream and clean everything up and have it recontaminated from upstream transport. So locations and sequencing are important and are benefited from this approach. We use the watershed analysis work to evaluate the effectiveness of the remedy and earlier, now while we're in the FS stage, to evaluate the relative effectiveness of different alternatives. It can also be used to assess long-term natural recovery and provide essential data for the design of in-water work in water remedial technologies. If we have a hydraulic model that tells us sediment transport rates, water surface elevations at different flows, velocities, shear stresses, all the hydraulic information, anything we do in the water benefits from that information. So if we're going to dredge or if we're going to build a bank stabilization project or design a sediment trap, the watershed study in the context and then the hydraulic model provide the basis for designing each of those aspects of the remedy. I'm going to talk a little bit also about how we use treatability testing to refine the remedial technologies. We worked on a bank stabilization project on Turkey Creek, which is one of the tributaries to Spring River. And the idea we had was let's consider the environment. We're trying to work within a natural channel or a natural channel network. Riprap is a conventional bank stabilization measure, large rock, and you size the rock based on the velocities that the channel is going to put on that bank. It's not a new technology, but it hasn't been used a lot in remedial design. But soil bioengineering bank stabilization is an alternative to hard rock bank stabilization measures. And the innovation there is to use living plant material where you basically go cut live cuttings from willow plants. There are other species, dogwood, buttonbush, and it varies from place to place around the country. But there are species where you cut the live branches, you stick them in the ground, they'll root and grow. And taking advantage of those attributes of certain plants allows you to integrate living plant material into your bank stabilization, so that you end up with a better ecological result at the end of the day. In terms of treatability tests, I'll talk more about that bank stabilization on Turkey Creek, but here's just a list of kinds of things that we're testing with these treatability studies. Dredging and material handling, sediment traps. There are multiple sediment traps that have been built out here. Wetlands to treat water quality, biochar applications. Biochar is basically like activated carbon that you can use as a chemical treatment for surface water that's contaminated. And bank stabilization. Again, this bank stabilization is a key component because it keeps the migrating river from eating into these contaminated soils. So let me talk quickly about Turkey Creek. This is just one of the details. It shows in cross-section the bank where we picked a location where soil on the floodplain was contaminated by a pile of mine waste. That pile has since been removed, but there's still some contamination in the soils. It's cleaned up to upland standards, but those soils eroding into the creek are still above the cleanup standards for aquatic receptors. This detail shows rocks at the toe, large boulders that stabilize the toe of slope where the erosion is most intense. And above that, each of these is a soil lift, somewhere between 12 and 18 inches thick. And in between each lift, you place these live branch cuttings, and they root out and grow. Our study, we did this, as I said earlier, at a small scale so we could try it out, see if there were any problems that were site-specific, logistical challenges. Ferret out all the challenges so that when we roll this up to a bigger scale, you know, on Big River, we might be doing anywhere from 20 to 50 miles of bank stabilization. You know, you don't want to go figure it out later if you can try it at a small scale and work out the bugs. So a little bit more detail. I've already covered the fact that it was remediated on the upland already. Turkey Creek is dynamic. It moves around. That was one of the issues I'll talk about from the pilot study. There's frequent flooding out of the channel. It happens every year, sometimes multiple times. It happened three times during our construction activities. There's a high volume of gravel bed load moving down the river, so it's a very dynamic stream bed, and it moves the bars in the channel around frequently, which moves the shear stresses around frequently and changes the forces that apply to these banks. And then, of course, the bank erosion mobilizes and spreads contaminated soil from the floodplain. So the strategy and approach for this project, this pilot study, this treatability study, was to start by identifying the extent of channel instability adjacent to the contaminated soil zone. This is a picture of the bank after the upland remedy was complete, but before we did anything to the bank. And this is the stream flowing toward us in this image. Here's a plan view, just an aerial. Flow is from right to left, and we worked on this bank right here. And this is just a Google image showing the historic chat pile. Chat is pea gravel-sized mine waste material that comes from the initial processing of the ore. And here's Turkey Creek flowing towards the top of this image. For the study, we designed and installed the bank protection. We used the rock toe and the live branch layering. And right now, we are in the process of monitoring plant establishment. Is the bank staying stable? Is the channel changing? Are there any changes in sediment chemistry? That's part of our ongoing monitoring. And I'm going to throw out the term adaptive management here. Adaptive management is a risk management strategy and a way to ensure greater success overall. You have an idea how these natural systems work, but they don't always behave the way that you think or the way your model predicts. And so to deal with that uncertainty, I like to use adaptive management to identify in advance where is that uncertainty, how are things likely to change, and to build contingencies and preferably to fund those contingencies in advance so that if they happen, you already have a plan and you're ready to deploy it. This is just a sampling from the design sheets. This is the detail I showed you earlier. Here's another design cross-section, vertically exaggerated, but this shows a particular section. We had about a dozen sections like this where we're showing exactly what the gradient would be on the slope and the grading plan. This one just shows the arc of the bank stabilization. This is a very neat arc, and in reality, nature is messy, so this is approximate. We didn't stick exactly to this neat arc, but this shows the general zone in which we emplaced this bank protection. We used the HECRAS model again, but here for a much smaller scale. We were just looking at about 1,000 feet of channel instead of 120 kilometers. But the model is versatile. We used it to come up with water surface elevations and velocities to inform this design and make sure that the bank stabilization would be sturdy under the range of flow conditions that we expected. Even though it's smaller, we're still up in more than 10,000 CFS at a 100-year event for this creek, and that's going to put a few feet of water on that floodplain. So this it definitely makes for a dynamic setting to work in. So during construction, here's some photos of the construction. You can see here the live branch layers sitting on top of each of those soil lifts. You can see the rock toe along the base of the slope, which is protecting the toe against being undercut by flows. Here's another image showing the same thing from a different angle. All these are live branches starting to leaf out. And then here's just an earlier picture showing the construction process. The soil, I'll mention, was prepared on site. We blended organic topsoil with stream gravel. We need good growing medium, so we need to have organics in it, but we need it to be structurally sound as well and hold that bank in place. Over time, these branches leaf out and turn into willow plants and buttonbush plants, etc. And that dense root mat that you get from the growth of these plants is your bank stabilization. The geotextile here is coconut fiber, and the density of that can be manufactured differently so that you have it designed to rot after a year, or rot after 5 years, or rot after 10 years. This is a temporary measure, and it basically holds the bank in place until these plants establish their roots and grow and provide the permanent protection on top of these rocks. So, issues and solutions. A lot of things happened during our construction. We were on site for about 6 weeks. If you're working with living plants, you have to work a certain time of year. You can't just go do it any time of year. You want to harvest the living plant material during the dormant phase, in the cold. And then you don't want to handle it any more than you have to. You want to minimize storage and handling. Otherwise, you're going to lose more of those plants. So optimal survival of your plants is harvest them in the cold, plant them in the cold. But that creates problems because if you're trying to do all this earthwork along an active stream, when does it flood most? When is it subject to flooding and erosion and bad weather that's going to keep you from building? Our reality out here was we had 3 overbank flood events during construction, and the channel actually relocated itself away from our bank by depositing a new gravel bar. All that could be anticipated, and even though the main active channel has moved away from the bank temporarily, it's a temporary situation and a very dynamic stream. It will move back there, and when it does, it'll encounter a stabilized bank. So what did we learn? We learned that if you're working between April and September, when you have your main rainfall events and flood events, you need to allow for wet weather days. Build that into your schedule. If you finish early, great, but be prepared to have start and stop because of bad weather. Plan to replace your dead plants after a year. Generally speaking, you warranty the plants for a year, and anything that dies, you go out and replace. More often, you're looking at more of a 5-year period to make sure those plants are going to stay there permanently. Along the way, you can anticipate when it's going to flood. Make sure you stabilize and button up the work area. You know, don't leave the bank half excavated if you know it's going to flood tomorrow. Take the time that day to stabilize things and get to a good temporary stopping point. Also, we looked at ways to alter the design so that we don't have to do the plant installation at the same time we're doing the earthwork. If you work with a design like this, where you have soil lifts, you have to put the plants in while you're doing the earthwork. But if you instead just stabilize the whole bank with the fabric and you use stakes, living plants, you drive them in or place them in the soil through the mat, you can put them in at the optimal time, and you can separate that from the earthwork and do that at the optimal time. It changes the structure of your bank, but it can end up giving you the nimbleness that you need to wrestle with the bad weather. I mentioned previously that the channel changed. This was a field sketch done by the engineer on site, and I included it in this presentation, even though it happened months ago, just to show things happen fast, you have to respond quickly. The channel used to follow this path and go along our bank. A whole new gravel bar deposited here and sent the channel around to the opposite bank. It still comes in and impacts down here, and sometime in the future it's going to reoccupy this zone as the deposition occurs and bounces the channel back and forth. But this was a big change. We had our temporary crossing. All our staging areas was on the south side of the creek. We had to cross over this. We had to rebuild this crossing a couple of times because it'd get partially washed out from a flood. Our solutions, we used this adaptive management approach. Again, we could anticipate this kind of thing. We considered changes to the design and said, no, this is still going to be needed after the river moves back sometime in the future. And it's great, actually, fortuitous, because it takes the pressure off this bank while we're waiting for the plants to get established. And then once the plants are established, the flow will reoccupy this channel. So a few concluding remarks. This is my philosophy. I think that a watershed perspective, watershed sciences, and adaptive management provide a really great basis for a strategic, cost-effective approach to remediating contaminated watersheds. This is a great approach for places where you've got contamination spread out over a whole drainage network regionally, and you've got dozens, if not hundreds of miles of impacted streams. Hydrology, hydraulics, sediment transport, geomorphology, these are the sciences that all provide essential context for the analysis and remediation of these watersheds. I think to try to do any of this in the absence of that framework, you're going to face an uphill battle. And my hope is that what I presented today illustrates how you can use watershed sciences on impacted watersheds, showing the comparison between Big River and Spring River demonstrates that this is adaptable. These are similar watersheds in terms of climate and landscape, but we're showing a variation in scale from a main river to smaller tributaries. But the same adaptability is available for very different kinds of landscapes. But the principle is to use watershed sciences to establish your baseline, your conceptual site model, and the tools you need to diagnose, treat, and ultimately remediate these places. You can integrate natural processes into the remedial actions. It's a step up from the passive approach of natural recovery. I'm not going to slam natural recovery. I think it's an important tool in the toolbox, but this is different than natural recovery. It's a partnership between the proactive design and the natural processes. You harness those processes and bring them into the approach. I've already talked about adaptation. And then I'll just reiterate that the treatability studies provide a way to try things out on a smaller scale. If you're working in an innovative space, Don't do it at full scale the first time. Try it out on a small scale, make sure it's going to work, adapt it, and then scale it up. I just want to acknowledge quickly these people. There are more people that have been involved, but Jeff Hodge and Duo Gavanison, both at HGL, were close collaborators throughout. Jeff is the task order manager so that I can focus on the science and the technical stuff. I don't have to deal with invoices and such things. Dua is the giant brain, PhD, PE. He ran the model. I run the model too, but in this case, I was feeding him guidance, and he ran the model and did the heavy lifting on setting that up. Greg Bach, Steve Kemp, Elizabeth, or Liz Hagenmeyer are all RPMs. Greg is the RPM, Regional Project Manager for EPA Region 7 on the Big River. Steve and Elizabeth are both RPMs on different parts of the Spring River. And Gene Gunn, I acknowledge Gene, he reviewed this presentation for me to make sure that I wasn't speaking out of turn on anything. And he's been a founder of the programs to deal with these watersheds and a strong technical collaborator throughout the process. Thank you to them. And that's my last slide. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
All right. Thank you so much, Shane. I think we're going to move into the question period now. And I'll remind the audience that there's a small window in the lower right corner called the Q&A window where you can continue to send in comments and questions for Shane. We'll take as many as we can in the time that we have remaining. And Shane, if you're ready, I'm going to jump right in here. And a number of people have sent in questions about the sediment traps that you talked about. They are interested in more information on how they work, if you've tested those in the field, or what was your testing approach when you were using them in the field, and how did what kind of results did you get?
Good questions. And we're looking at different kinds of sediment traps. I'll give a quick primer. And I'll just go back to this slide because this is one of our pilot tests that we're developing down on sediment, or down on Spring River now. So sediment trap, you're basically taking advantage of hydraulic sorting. You have different kinds of sediment traps. One strategy is called an offline trap. This graphic is an example of an offline sediment trap. This is the mainstream. It flows this way. There's an inlet channel where you divert some of the flow into the sediment trap. It's a low energy environment. The water's not cruising through here. It's going to sit in here in storage and give the sediment that's suspended time to settle out and stay in the trap. And then there's a return channel that takes the water after it's been deprived of as much sediment as you can and sends that cleaner or less sediment-laden water back into the channel. So this offline trap strategy, the key to this is when do you start sending water into it? Well, it doesn't make sense to divert clean water at low flow into this trap. So you set the elevation of this inlet and the size of this channel to control when and how much water goes into the trap. Generally speaking, rule of thumb, the sediment bed starts to mobilize at half of the two-year flow recurrence value. So if the two-year flow event is 1,000 CFS, rule of thumb, this bed is going to start to mobilize at 500. It's a rule of thumb, but it's proven up, and every one of these I've worked on to be somewhere close to that. You know, if I said it was 500, it might be 450 or 580. But the strategy is turn on the flow into the trap when there's sediment in the water. But you don't want to overwhelm the trap. You know, the function of the trap is dictated primarily by residence time. How long does water spend in this basin? And is that long enough for the sediment to settle from the top of the water column to the bottom? So there's a race between the settling and the flow through. So the residence time is a ratio between the volume of water stored in the trap and the flow-through rate. The longer the residence time, the longer the sediment has to settle. Coarse sediment, sand, coarse sand, the top end of that is 2 millimeters. Sand settles in seconds. it settles pretty fast. Silt settles in minutes, or really fine silt settles in hours. So you want to set the flow through rate and the volume of the trap, the size of it, area depth, so that you have enough time for your target sediment to settle out. If you only have so much space and so much volume, then you limit the flow coming in. Those are your adjustments that you can make in the design. It's pretty simple. You're digging a hole, routing water through it. You control how much water. Other kinds of sediment traps I'll make mention of, this is an offline trap. You could do the same thing in the river. So on the big river, we're thinking about, can we enhance deposition within zones of the river that are already collecting sediment? There are places where there are historic mill dams, concrete dams that are only a few feet high, but they cause deposition upstream. Can we go harvest the sediment there and let it accumulate there again, and do it again in a year or in 5 years or whatever the frequency needs to be to keep up with the sediment deposition? There are other kinds of traps that focus on permanent deposition. Like this is a trap where you collect sediment, remove it, collect it, remove it, collect it, remove it in cycles until you're done. Other places you can just promote deposition out on the floodplain and then come in later and cap it and just isolate it that way. I think that's the end of my answer for now. I can answer more questions.
Okay. Do you have any data on the effectiveness of these traps? How much do they take out? How well do they work?
None of them are 100% efficient. I mean, first of all, you're diverting a portion of flow. So if you look at Big River and you say, well, I would need thousands of acres of storage in order to keep up with, the flow rate. The floodplain itself is a natural sediment trap in that respect. There is a sediment trap that was built near Mammoth on the Spring River, Mammoth Bridge, Mammoth Creek. It's called the Mammoth Trap. That trap is a couple acres. Water flows. It's very much like this sketch. It will capture hundreds of yards of material every year. But we have not yet answered all of those questions, how much sediment is coming down the system and how many traps would we need to do more than a drop in the bucket. A single trap like this is going to take a small amount of the sediment and transport, but the vast majority of water and sediment suspended in it is going to bypass this trap because we're only taking so many cubic feet of that water into the trap. The strategy is to use the sediment trap to speed along the process by removing as much mass as we can of this fine sediment. This will work better on the systems on Spring River, I think, where you have more coarse material in the riverbed, which is relatively clean. The gravel is not nearly as contaminated as the silt. So if we just need to remove the silt, for every 10,000 yards of sediment, there might be 5% of that's silt that we need to collect in these traps. So it's an easier lift. It's an easier challenge. And these more dynamic systems give you more opportunity to sort out the fines with a strategy like this. In the Big River, where you have, millions of tons of material moving, and you can get hundreds or thousands of tons of material with a set of traps, you're still an order of magnitude or two less than what's needed if you wanted to do it all with traps. So the traps are a component of it. The real remedy, I think, in Big River is going to be accomplished through the bank stabilization and cutting off that ongoing source.
Okay. And very quickly, since you're on this picture, I'll ask a question, and then I want to switch gears to questions about source treatment or addressing the sources, since you just said that. So very quickly, a couple of people wanted to know, why are you planting things horizontally? And you have an illustration of that.
Well, I had a weeping willow tree in my yard when I was a kid, and anytime there was a windstorm, chunks of it would fall in the yard, and we'd have five weeping willow trees. It really doesn't matter how these branches are oriented. The part that's exposed to sunlight is going to grow towards the sunlight. The horizontal planting is really just a way of working with the structure of these soil lifts. The bank is more stable because it's got this stacked layers of soil with these roots. The roots are going to emanate from these stalks and go more or less parallel to the bank. They can be put in at any angle. The orientation isn't going to prevent them from growing well on the part that's exposed.
Okay. Okay. We had a couple of questions just talking about source work. And people are commenting here that you're talking about strategies that are seem to be focusing on the depositional zones and that you're not applying this approach in your source areas. And so people wanted to confirm, A, are you not using this type of effort or this work in the source areas? And if you're not, what are you doing, or have you not even considered it, and would you consider it in the source areas?
Good news. The source areas are being addressed, and they're being addressed first. The way that EPA has organized these watersheds, these sites, is by different operable units. There are multiple operable units dealing with the massive piles of tailings on the landscape that are the primary sources. In addition to those piles, there are other slime ponds and water draining directly out of mine openings. There's places where it's artesian. Other operable units outside of my scope have been dealing with the upland remedy. And so we don't come in and deal with the drainage network until those sources have been adequately controlled. It doesn't make sense to, because you're just going to recontaminate this and spend all this effort to have it covered up with contaminants again. So, yes, upland work is being done. A lot of that is just conventional remedies of contaminated bulk material. If you have millions of tons of mine waste, do you aggregate it all in a repository, isolate it that way, haul it away somewhere, isolate it in place, cover it, cap it, make sure that water doesn't flow through it, minimize those things. So that there are conventional remedies being applied to the sources on the landscape, and those are being sequenced in advance of dealing with the drainage network.
Okay. I have a few other questions, but I know that we are running short on time, so we'll try to get in short answers to as many questions as we can with what we have left here. The very first question is asking about the overall sort of maintenance requirements and lifespan for the engineered bank stabilization. So how long will that work? What do you have to do every year to keep it up?
Generally speaking, your maintenance and monitoring are heavily focused on the first 5 years. The most important thing is to make sure the plants are established. And I talked about mortality and the ways to minimize plant mortality in that establishment period. But the fundamental strategy is go out and monitor, see what's lived and what's died. Replace it where it's died. Try to diagnose why it died in those locations. Is it not getting watered? Is it coarser soil and it's draining too fast? Was it eroded by the channel and undercut? But you want to monitor it and fix it where it's been damaged or where the plants have died within that first 1 to 5 years. Once the plants are established, the plants are going to continue to grow. They'll continue to propagate. As I said, these living cuttings, go back to the weeping willow in my yard. Every piece that fell down became a new tree. You could cut a chunk of a branch and put it in the yard and it would grow. So these things are self-propagating and should maintain themselves in place for the long term.
All right, fantastic. There were a number of other questions looking for information on the budget for the bank stabilization work, if you have any of that information. Some people had questions about the models that you were developing and how well they lined up with the data, how long it took to develop those models. We don't have time to get into all of those questions, but I did want to circle back to an answer you provided earlier. For people who have more specific questions about some of the projects you worked on, can they follow up with you for questions afterwards?
Absolutely. My email is included in the information. Just shoot me an email, and I'll be happy to talk with you one-on-one at any point.
All right, fantastic. So as noted, if you had a question in the queue and we couldn't get to it live, I do apologize, but we're going to go ahead and close out today's Q&A section and just go through a few quick reminders, but Shane has been kind enough to offer that option to reach out to him directly, and I'll be happy to talk with you all one-on-one. Kate, if you're still on the line, do you want to quickly remind everybody of the ongoing series before I start our closing reminders?
Sure. Thank you, Jean. Thank you, everybody, for attending. Thanks, Shane, for a great and informative presentation. As you can see from the slide that's up now, we have 5 future webinars scheduled. Again, commonalities in all of these are design and construction issues, but the subject, scope, and types of sites that we talk about really range, so I encourage you to keep an eye on these and register. Also, on the following slides, we have a DCHWS West Symposium coming up in November. We're going to be talking about project management. We're going to be talking about changing site approaches, thermal remedies, mining remedies, large sediment remedies, challenging stakeholder remedies. So if you found this interesting and you're interested in any of those topics, I encourage you to take a look at the agenda, go to the website, and if you're interested, please register and join us. We'd appreciate you all coming. And with that, Jean, we can close it out.
All right. Thank you so much, Kate. So I want to echo those thanks to all the participants, as well as Shane and Kate, who shared their expertise and took time to help deliver this session. For those of you who are interested in learning about future sessions, I strongly encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. It goes out on the first of each month, and as soon as sessions are open for registration, we'll advertise it in that free newsletter. A number of you asked for copies of the materials. You'll find it under Seminar Resources. I've also pasted it into the Q&A window, so you can scroll through there and you'll find a link. I will also remind you that Shane's contact information can be found within the materials. We've made it available on the seminar page, so as noted, if you had site-specific questions that we couldn't get to today, you're certainly welcome to reach out to him directly to chat. And I would ask each of you to fill out the brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. A number of you have asked about certificates, and the one way to get a certificate on our webinars is to fill out the feedback form. If you fill that form out and you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire session, you will then immediately have access to a certificate documenting your participation that you can either save or print out for your own records. Each person, if you happen to join as a group in a conference room, can fill out that feedback form even if they didn't register individually. So if you were in a room with others, if you could share the link to the feedback form with those other parties so that they can send in their own feedback to get their own certificate, we would greatly appreciate it. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, guess what? You can still follow the links to that seminar feedback form, share your thoughts based off the replay, and get a certificate after watching the entire archived version. We should have information about the archived version out in about 1 week. You'll automatically receive an email from me with instructions on how to replay it. As Kate noted, session number 2 is already open. We've also included a link to that earlier in the Q&A, and I hope that we'll see you come back for another session in the series. So I'll go ahead and again thank the organizers, our speakers, and our participants for